You're listening to an episode of the Elephant in the Room podcast brought to you by The Purpose Room in partnership with the India Justice Report. Each month, we will bring to you insights on the workings of the Indian justice system. We will also explore the notion of justice and what it means to Indians. My guests on this episode of the Elephant in the Room podcast are Surya Prakash B.S., a fellow and program director at Daksh, working on judicial reforms, and Radhika Jha, a research executive and legal consultant at Common Cause. Radhika is also the lead researcher for the Status of Policing in India report series. Thank you, Radhika, Surya, and Valay, for being here today to record another episode of the India Justice Report.
Thank you, Sudha, for having us.
Thank you.
So let's just get started with the questions. We often speak about justice as being essential to the overall development of any country, including economic development. In fact, one of the metrics for development is how much litigation takes place in a country. Do you feel in India, center and states have been given enough attention towards ensuring access to justice for all?
So let me take that, Sudha. So the connection between economic development and the justice sector, it seems to have captured the attention only of economists or such esoteric researchers. But the common experience bears out this connection very well. If you don't have trust in a person, you will need to take the extra effort of putting down the terms and conditions. And if those terms and conditions you are sure will not be fulfilled, you will take advance deposit, or you will be having a lot of plan B, plan C, plan D. And finally, you will end up going into court if many of those are not met. That puts a lot of pressure on the citizens to be aware of the laws and to back themselves up with these legal recourses, which is a cost, which is time, which is a wastage of resources. These are commercial, but economic development is not only about commercial transactions. It is also about how citizens trust each other outside of economic transactions too, like your neighbor, like somebody you're just passing by on the streets. If the crime rate is high, people will not go out in the streets late at night. That affects economic activity, right? If people don't have trust with each other, then you will see a rise in crime rate. It could be a recursive loop. So in India, the focus on justice sector has been on the formal justice system, has been on making sure that the number of judges are increasing. From an access to justice perspective, there has been a lot of talk, there has been a lot of noise about getting people on board. So an analogy that I frequently use is a lot of the access to justice debate discourse in the country has been like trying to get the people on board a bus. We are all the privileged, you know, the well-to-do, etc. We are on a bus and we're getting the not so well-off onto the bus, saying, okay, come on to the bus. But what, the bus is not going anywhere. It's one thing to get them on board, but if the bus is not going anywhere, then all of us need to focus on the engine, on the driver, on the steering, right? And that is where a lot of the next level of discussions in this country need to be focused about. So when we say it has not been paid attention to, I would nuance it and say these two ways it needs to be focused more on in the next few years.
Thank you, Surya, for painting a very vivid picture of what justice means in the developmental context. Radhika, what is your take on this?
So I completely agree with Surya. And also, I'd like to add that it's not just that we are not paying attention to the justice system in India, but also the prioritization of the justice system is actually declining over the years. I mean, if we just look at the global standards, there is the World Justice Project, a Rule of Law Index, which ranked India at the 79th position. And it has shown a consistent decline over the last 4-5 years. When we look at only the criminal justice aspect of the Rule of Law Index, our position slips further to the 86th rank. So this is a clear indication of where we are headed. And I'm not saying that fiscal priority is the only method of trying to make an improvement in the system, but it is somewhere to start with. So just to give you an example, if you look at the judiciary, if we actually want to fill up the vacancies of the judges alone, I'm not talking about any of the support staff here, we need 5,000 more judges in the judiciary. And there's a shortage of court halls in the judiciary. So just to be able to accommodate the judges who are currently not part of the judicial system, we need at least 3,000 more court halls. So if you offer in the salaries of the judges, the infrastructural cost or the cost of renting, etc., this would become a significant budgetary allocation, which would be much higher than what we are allocating right now. For the police, we are spending about 0.7% of our GDP, which is much lower than the global standards. Countries mostly spend between 1 to 3% of their GDP on policing. So this is one of the areas where we need to start focusing on.
Moving on to the next question, Surya, I'll bring this to you. Given the close link between justice and economic development, do you think there are enough financial resources in developing our justice system, whether it is the prisons, the judiciary, legal aid, police, etc.?
Definitely. Just to build on what Radhika said just now, only on the courts and tribunals, we are spending 0.1%, including legal services authorities. 0.1% of the GDP is, compared to the other countries, 1%, 2%. It's a vast gap that needs to be made good at the earliest. Anybody who has seen the financials of the courts, the law and justice department, and the administration of justice side can see that there is a shortage of funds being allocated to the courts and tribunals, to the legal service authorities, the prisons, the forensic. So the entire justice system, the justice ecosystem needs more financial support. But there are some finer points that we need to be aware of before we agree to such a blanket statement. And that is what will make this next half an hour interesting. Yes, more funds are needed, but what?
So the shortcomings in the justice system are not just linked to how much funding is there. It is complex and nuanced. Whenever we talk about poor service delivery across sectors, roads, health, water, we blame it on poor governance and bad financial planning. How much does this hold true for justice delivery?
A lot of the public sector problems seem to be supply-oriented problems. There aren't enough roads, or there aren't enough schools, or there aren't enough teachers. So justice system in that sense is not different from other public delivery systems in saying we need more supply-side solutioning. So it is to that extent very similar. Where we do depart from other sectors is how can you say that they are not good? You can say this road is not good, so we need a bigger road or a wider road or a better quality. But how do you say that for courts? We're not talking here only about the buildings, right? We're talking about people. We're talking about the experience and the quality of justice, you know, that nebulous thing. So when we say that there is a bad financial planning, the beast around which we are trying to get our arms is also very difficult to grasp. So there is poor financial planning. There are reports that bear this out, how there is allocation. And the classic example is the 13th Finance Commission report, which was running from the period 2010 to 2015. And that allocated 5,000 crores. I think Dr. Vijay Kelkar made that award as the head of the Finance Commission. And out of that, only 1,000 crores were spent. 4,000 crores were allocated by the Finance Commission, but not spent. So there is this question of ability to absorb financial support. Also a question of whatever you are getting, are you able to spend it wisely? Are you prioritizing, right? So there is definitely a lack of capacity in the justice system to both utilize the funds and utilize it well. And in that sense, maybe it's poorer than other systems, other ecosystems like education, roads, or health, because of the kind of people who are in that sector. And I'll pause here and we can build upon this as we go along.
So I think a bunch of issues come into play. There is the resource crunch and the fact that even the resources that are available are not being utilized properly and optimally. But there's also the problem of lack of clarity and direction of the nature of certain projects and the functions that are covered under the project, which are funded by the states or the center. So I can give you the example of the Nirbhaya Fund. And this is one of the major funding projects, but ultimately we find the funds are being underutilized severely across the states. And we also see that the states very often don't know what to do with this fund. So they end up allocating them to things like CCTVs in railway stations. Nirbhaya fund, for some reason, was being used only for primarily, if not only, for the installation of CCTVs in cities. And now it's being used for the same thing in railway stations, which is not exactly a gender safety component. There's also another problem that we see is the underestimating of costs for areas which are not of high priority. One such area would be the prisoners or the prison inmates, most of whom are under trials, which means that they have not been convicted of their crime. So there is a lot of underestimation in the costs incurred for the welfare and for the basic requirements of these inmates. The mental health of the prisoners, as well as the physical health, is severely underreported, which means that ultimately there are not enough mental health or medical professionals available in the prisons. We found that there's the availability of 1.4 medical staff per prison. And a prison is a large unit. So 1.4 is a very small number to be able to provide facility to the entire unit. Also, there's the factor that we spend a majority of the funds that we get for, let's say, policing on regular expenditures like salaries. So 90% of the policing fund goes towards salaries of the police personnel. In a lot of states, it varies from state to state, but that's the average. So we don't really have any funds left for any kind of new or innovative policing strategies or making the police more people-centric. So these are just some of the issues which play into the bad financial planning of this sector.
As a layperson, I'd always blame the shortcomings of the system on the lack of funds. But both of you have just said that it is not necessarily just about financial resources, which is an eye-opener for me. And this segues neatly into my next question. So currently, the system struggles with both insufficient financial resources and the inability to absorb whatever funds are being given. Could you both weigh in on this with some examples such that our audience will better understand this linkage?
So Daksh did a survey called the Access to Justice Survey and followed it up with an Approaches to Justice survey. This was 2016 and 2017. One of the researchers went to a district just outside Calcutta, I think Hooghly it was, and he was asking questions in the court complex, and then the judge was kind enough to engage with this researcher, and he said, this court closes at 5. And he said, why? I mean, the court hall is supposed to stay on for at least 6 o'clock or so, right? The court staff will be there, litigants, lawyers, everything will be there, right? So, no, I mean, after 5, the landlord will object. So this is a court, and the court is saying that the landlord will object. So what is the problem with the landlord? So this is a rented property. Actually, this property is under dispute in the same court. So the court was running in a building that was under dispute. And then another court hall close by. During the court hearings, all of them was squatting, the cross leg, the Indian cross leg on the chairs, the lawyers were arguing. And the judge is sitting on this one. And this is highly unusual. What is happening? And then he said, no, there are a lot of those big mice that roam around the courthouse and we're all scared of it. So we're sitting with this is real life stories of the state of infrastructure in court halls. No doubt at all, it needs to be upgraded. No doubt at all, it needs to be made world-class, litigant-friendly, disabled-friendly, gender-friendly, washrooms, notice boards. Absolutely no doubt about it. Another example, and I'll stop here. A judge in a district court, there was some discussion, and we said, this has been addressed in this decision recently, or Supreme Court decision. I said, sir, hame nahi pata. I don't know how to accept latest judgments of the Supreme Court. Supreme Court of the country is giving a judgment and he does not have access to it because there is no awareness on how to access it. And then even if there are, the judgments that he can cite are only in certain databases which need to be paid for officially. Otherwise, he'll have to pay it out of his own pocket. So see the ends, the physical side and the knowledge side. We have a lot to do. Absolutely no doubt about it.
Radhika?
Yeah, the Comptroller and Auditor General of India the CAG. From time to time, they do auditing of the performance of police or prison in various states. So they found very interesting findings about how certain funds are being diverted in almost illegal ways. In 2020, the CAG found that the funds were being diverted towards villas and luxury cars for the chief of police of the Kerala police. This is a condition we found in one of our surveys. It's called the Status of Policing in India survey, conducted by Common Cause and Center for Study of Developing Societies. We found in the survey that almost half of the police personnel have faced situations where they don't have vehicles to go to the crime scene. They have faced situations where they don't have vehicles for carrying out their basic and most essential duties. Despite this, the funds are being diverted towards luxury cars for chief ministers and police chiefs. So there is always the issue of corruption and diversion of funds, which is a major roadblock. But also there's the simple sheer underutilization of funds. Very often, not just the police, but the entire justice system, as well as other systems of the government, they are not able to spend the entire fund that they've received. Let me just take the example of the modernization of police force project, which I was talking about earlier. This is one of the funds which has a share of both the union as well as the states to basically build the capacity of the police. The center provides 75% of the MPF fund, and the states have to provide 25%. The provision of the funds by the center is dependent on whether or not the states have provided their share of the funds. So a lot of states are unable to get any funds at all because they don't allocate their share of the fund to the MPF scheme. And even amongst the states that do, it is consistently almost across all the states, and over the years, it is underutilized. And also from my interaction with the police officers, it's not always the case that the people, the officials in power are just simply sitting on the funds and not making use of it. It's also a problem of the flow of the funds and the transfers and the time that it takes for the fund to actually reach the implementing agency. There's a study by the Niti Aayog of 2019, which found that in Bihar and Jharkhand, it takes about 190 days to transfer funds from the state treasuries to the implementing agency. So this basically means that half a year goes by in just a simple procedure of transferring funds. This example is from the Health Index, but I suspect it's very much valid for the justice sector as well. I've heard of examples where departments get funds for various schemes in the last month of the financial year, and then they are not able to show the expenditure, and ultimately the fund becomes underutilized. This is also often used as a strategy for basically depriving and for the government to say that, see, they don't spend the money, so we will not be giving them more money from next year. So if you transfer the funds very late and the department is unable to utilize the funds properly, then the budget for the next year goes down. It then becomes a political tool to systematically deprive certain sectors.
Wow, that's a lot to take in. But the examples do paint a vivid picture of everything that is wrong with the system. And clearly, there's no one silver bullet. This is such a complex issue with so many intertwining strands. For any change, I guess there has to be a systemic and long-term approach. So there's a similar question. Are more judges better or having fewer good judges better? And same goes for police.
So sanction strength versus current working strength is one delta that needs to be focused on. Now, we have done some research which shows that, for example, just assume that one court complex had 10 judges and two more additional posts were created. Right, they were supposed to have 10, they had 10, and then it got expanded to 12. The case load is the same because it is in that same jurisdiction. That did not decrease the life cycle of cases very significantly. However, there is another research report that Manaswini Rao, economist from Berkeley University, has done. So she has shown if you're supposed to have 10, but you have less than 10, that does play a role. So when you say more judges, there is a need to differentiate between going up to sanction strength or going beyond sanction strength. We still don't know how sanction strength is arrived at. There is still no scientific basis that we have been able to extract from many conversations we have had on how sanction strength is arrived at, but we can take it to be a rule of thumb and therefore work towards making sure at least those number of people are there.
Yes. For me, it's actually not a question of either or. So on the one hand, we know that this sector is majorly understaffed. We did a survey with police personnel in 2019 under the Status of Policing in India Report project. And we found that the average Indian police person works for about 8 hours a day. And half of the police personnel don't even get a weekly off. So the police are overworked. The judges are overworked. There is no doubt about it. And this can only be resolved through filling up the vacancies at the very least. How essential the police or the sector is became evidently clear during the national lockdown after the pandemic in 2020, where the police virtually became the gatekeepers of not just the criminal justice system, but the entire government. So from enforcing the lockdown to distributing rations to people, to distributing cooked meals and medical essentials, accommodating people in shelter homes, they were doing all of the firefighting work during this period. And then in such situations, it stares in your face how understaffed and under-resourced our police system actually is. But at the same time, having quality police personnel is also very, very important, if not more important than having more police. So what I mean by quality is, one, police who are properly trained, not just in their daily functioning and their daily performance of duties and weapons and physical training, but also in the legal and constitutional provisions. We need to start focusing on the due process, the rule of law. And this in itself, in my opinion, will bring out changes in their attitudes towards human rights issues or gender issues, caste issues, all of these. We need to have a more diverse police force, which is an aspect of quality or a good police force. Also, a diverse judicial system. The entire justice system needs to be more representative of people from marginalized sections of the society. And when we talk about good police or good judges, my focus is less on the inherent goodness of people or the training aspect, but more on the structural frameworks that kind of minimize the scope for any undue practices. So even though we might have principally laws in place which prohibit the officials from deviating from the rule of law, basically, but there's virtually no procedure to check this and to implement these legal frameworks. And I feel that training would only have a limited impact on how much this can change the attitudes or the behavior of the personnel who form the system. And I think we also need to start looking at practices which ensure the implementation of the rule of law.
Yeah, I think currently the focus is a lot on physical training and not much else. Go ahead, Surya.
So to go back to your original question, Sudha, on whether more judges are sufficient, the difference between police and courts. Our police are in charge of law and order, right? So using population to police personnel is a good way to get a sense of whether you have the right number of police people per square kilometer or per lakh population. That should not work the same way for judges, because not every citizen has an interaction with the courts, right? Of course, rule of law is upheld by the court, but then from adjudication function, their work is restricted to cases that come before them. So the differentiation between police personnel per population and judges per population is very, very stark, and it really should not be per population. It should be judges per lakh cases or million cases or something like that.
I think from the outside of you as a lay person, when we make comments on either the judiciary or police, we usually tend to make blanket statements without really understanding what the real issues are. So moving on to the next question, in the last few years, have you seen more fiscal priority being given to the justice sector? Is there a trend that shows?
So I think that there has improvement, but there's a lot to be desired. And I also feel that the fiscal priority or more budget or just simply giving more money does not always translate into better systems. And we need to always be aware of the fact when we look at the budgets. And sometimes it can actually mean the opposite. So, for instance, in the police, the most budgeted states are often the conflict states. So, presumably, a large share of their funds go into making the police more better armed and more aggressive policing instead of necessarily focusing on people-centric policing. And another example of how the funds can actually be utilized for what is not necessarily people-centric policing is how much the states spend on CCTVs in the name of women's safety and crime prevention. So Delhi, Hyderabad, a lot of the states have been pushing for installation of more and more CCTVs and have been spending hundreds of crores on its installation. When the academic literature around this shows that there's hardly any effect of impact of CCTVs on crime rates. If you look at any of the literature from across the world, it shows that they don't really impact crime in a lot of ways, aside from maybe a few types of crimes like traffic crimes, etc. But what these surveillance technologies are being used for is an issue that needs to be probed. So we know that Hyderabad has been investing in surveillance technologies like CCTVs, but also the facial recognition technology. They are investing in drones, etc. And these technologies are frequently being used against common people who have not committed any offense. So there are people in Hyderabad who've been stopped by the police and had their picture taken by the police officer for facial recognition technology. And this was a common person who was not committing any illegal act. He was just walking down the road. So what this money is being used towards and who is benefiting is something that we need to be very careful about. We also need to look at the justice system not as a standalone unit, but in a more comprehensive sense to see who are the people who are charged with offenses, what kind of cases go into court. So in India, we know that the people who are under trials in our prisons are mostly lower class from either or Muslim communities or OBC communities. They are undereducated, and majority of the inmates are incarcerated for petty crimes. So there's also the whole argument of defunding the police, which started making rounds in USA after the George Floyd murder. The argument is basically that there needs to be diversion of funds from the police. There needs to be lesser funds provided to the police and reallocating them to non-policing forms of social safety. So let's say for mental health, for shelter homes, for education, community support, social services, which are the reasons why our prisons are being filled by mentally ill, poor, and socially disadvantaged people. So we need to go back to the root of the issue instead of focusing just on funding the police and using this as a kind of band-aid mechanism.
Surya, you have anything to add?
So there has been no defunding the police in India. There has been an increase of funding in India. It has gone towards technology capacity building. It has gone towards ensuring that they are modernized. Whether that is right is a separate question, but there is no cutting down on budgeting to the police. So on the course, the 15th Finance Commission, which is the latest one last year, so it allocated 9,750 crores, the highest ever by a Finance Commission. Half of that went to fast-track courts for women, child sexual offenses, and other such grievous offenses that need to be resolved on fast footing. So it is going towards that. Half of the Finance Commission's outlay towards the judiciary is for such fast-track courts. The fast-track courts are the solution to such crimes or handling such disputes is another question. But prioritization is there as a mindset. We always tend to think of budgets at a very central level, but the judiciary is actually handled by both the central and the government. So if you see both the state and the central, it becomes a mixed bag. Some states have increased their funding. Some states have not increased their funding. So we don't know what to make of that story. The other thing that we also need to think about when we think about budgets is it just an absolute increase or is it a qualitative increase? Which I think Radhika made the point in the police earlier. For example, Is it going more towards technology for training? Is it to capacity building within the judiciary itself? Clearly, we don't see too much of a positive trend at all. In absolute terms, maybe because of the headcount change, maybe because of the infrastructure spend, there seems to be an increase. But qualitative difference is not to be seen, unfortunately.
So moving on to the next question, and it has some elements of what we've discussed already. Which areas of the justice sector need more fiscal support than others? Because like we discussed, more funding doesn't mean it is going into the right place. And we've seen problems. The judiciary is perhaps well-funded and the police too. Then why do we have overworked judges or poorly paid policemen and huge backlogs?
Yeah. So to speak about the judiciary, their salaries are definitely above par, comparative civil servant experience, etc. But they are still overworked is not to be doubted. So then where should the spending go? Is it towards more people or is it towards technology that can pick up some of the burden, or should it be towards research support to make life simpler, to improve the quality of justice, or is it towards process reengineering so that the litigant experience of the court process is not as harrowing as it is currently? The answer is all of these, right? So we seem to think of budgeting as a very incremental thing. Oh, 5% more, 10% more. I'm meeting my, you know, health is 10%, judiciary is 5%. So I'm okay, not so bad. But systemic change, which is what everybody is talking about, large systemic change needs to happen to transform the way citizens engage with the courts. And it can't be a linear graph. It has to be a step function. Somewhere there has to be a call and say, you know what, next 5 years, we're going to dramatically increase the funding. And then maybe it will plateau. It will definitely plateau, right? So all systemic changes are step functions that will require large budget commitments over the medium term, starting now. And that is what needs to be told consistently to the decision makers.
Surya's right that police and judiciary budgeting has only increased over the years. It has not decreased. And they are relatively better funded for sure. But also we need to look at, are we only talking about salaries here, but also the cost that goes into them actually performing their duties. We have examples from UP and Bihar, which talk about how police often don't even have the money to be able to take an unclaimed dead body to the hospital, to the morgue.
So I find that hard to believe. Sorry. It must be some systemic failure somewhere.
Very jaded response, Surya, because I feel whenever my interaction with the police, and especially local police, whether it is in Mumbai or Gurgaon, the conditions in which they function, it is pathetic, really. But anyway, I will let Radhika continue with that answer.
Coming back to your original question of which area needs more fiscal support, for sure, legal aid is an area which is very, very underfunded. A lot of states have not been providing any funds at all for legal aid, despite the fact that it's a constitutional right provided to the citizens, and almost 80% of our population actually qualifies for free legal aid. So this is one area which is very neglected. The situation has improved over the last couple of years, but there's a lot that needs to be done. There's also the prison, which continues to be a low priority area. So if we take out the cost of the staff of the prison and the cost of food, etc., we find that on an average, Indian prisons spend about 119 rupees per inmate. And this is an overestimation, by the way. So in reality, we would actually be spending a lot lesser. And only 1% of the budget goes towards their education. 4% goes on their medical needs. These are areas which are completely ignored simply because there is no body asking for reforms in this particular sector. The public opinion is generally that these are criminals, so they don't deserve a more comfortable life. But we need to acknowledge that a majority of our inmates are actually under trials. they are supposed to be innocent until proven guilty. So this is another area which needs a lot more resources. And I also think that we need to start looking at more innovative, newer, and more wholesome ways of addressing the issue of justice. We need to start looking at victim-oriented justice and restorative justice, reformative justice. These are areas which have not been prioritized at all. Forget about being funded also. So the compensation to victims or any kind of rehabilitative scheme for victims or offenders are areas which are not looked at all. And in fact, there is some evidence to suggest that this would actually be more cost effective also. So we've seen that open prisons, for instance, are actually cheaper compared to the traditional conventional prisons. And of course, this is a step in the direction of reformative, restorative justice. So doing a cost-benefit analysis for these kind of methods is crucial to be able to decide where and how we want to put the money.
So just a couple of points to build on that. If a lot of the prisons are under trials, instead of making their life better in prison, really we should be focusing on getting them out of prisons through faster bail disposals, right? Bail is the rule. So that is why the India Justice Report is so important. You're taking a systemic view of things. Instead of building bigger waiting rooms in court complexes so that litigants and lawyers can relax, you should be focusing on making sure that they spend as little time as possible in courts. That is the systemic view of things. Otherwise, you're just making life more comfortable in the queue. And the one thing that possibly we have not touched upon are the forensic labs. Hugely important from the criminal justice point of view, even in many civil matters, there needs to be a ramping up of capacity. More labs need to come up. They need to be equipped to handle digital evidence that is landing up before them increasingly. So that is another vertical which the state governments have to do. The central government has increased allocation. It is setting up more regional labs. The state governments now need to up their game and match those steps.
There's no simple answer, as with everything in the justice system. But I agree that the India Justice Report, what it does, it gives you a view of all the pillars and everything. And it is not just treating things in silos.
You can agree, you can disagree, but you can't ignore the India Justice Report.
Absolutely, which is brilliant. Surya, this is a question for you. So Radhika has already alluded to it, that legal aid is something that is constitutionally granted to 80% of Indian citizens, and it's a constitutional right. But India spends an abysmal amount of money on providing legal aid. It is just 1.30, which is ridiculous. And as statistics show, even countries like Argentina spend more than us. Is this an issue of funding? What is with the system?
The causes are many. Clearly, only increasing budgetary allocations is not going to solve the problem. There needs to be more people giving legal aid. And there is no doubt about that, right? If you want to service a population as large as ours, we're a continent, then it can't be done through the current number of people doing legal aid. How do we do that? One of that is for state to say, I will pay some more people. The other is the volunteer network. The other is the college students. The other is the academia, right? The other is technology. How can you make laws more accessible? How can you make positions on fact? I have been hit by a car. I have been evicted from my house. There should be answers ready for such kind of situations. Can these be made available at a fingertips through mobile apps? I mean, apps can't solve everything, but from a knowledge perspective, at least it should be at the fingertips of the people who need them. So legal aid, making people aware of their rights, ensuring that they're able to knock on the right doors and not going to the local bhai to solve their problems. These are things that need more than just increasing in budgetary allocations. It needs imagination. It needs a longer time system view.
Also, to come back to Surya's earlier point about how we need to focus on getting people out of prisons and reducing people's times in court. I mean, the fact that that focus is missing is very obvious from the funding and the resources that are granted to legal aid or legal awareness. So until 2017, I think the fees that was provided to the legal aid lawyers in Mumbai was, I think, 900 for the entire trial. Now, one trial usually lasts for several years. And if this is the amount that is being paid to legal aid lawyers, there will obviously be an unwillingness of lawyers to be a part of this system, to volunteer for this system. And amongst the cohort that comes in, there is going to be the question of quality. So if you're not providing quality legal aid, then everything just becomes a farce. And people will continue to stay in prisons and continue to visit courts over and over again. System is not going to change. So the solution to reducing even the cost of the courts and prisons is actually in prioritizing legal aid to a great extent.
Perhaps a root and branch review of how we're dispensing legal aid in the country and how it can be more effective. And this is my last question to you today. In countries like the US, people have been trying to weigh the cost of crime and so on. Are there similar efforts being made in India, perhaps to see how it impacts on the ability to do business and attract investment, etc.? Radhika, would you like to answer this?
Yes. So not a lot of effort is being actually made to look into the cost of crime. And if we go by what some of the global studies suggest, we actually find that we spend a major share of our GDP on violence. So the cost of violence, according to the Global Peace Index, was $742 billion in 2016, which accounted for about 9% of our GDP. So, I mean, one, there is the cost of violence itself. We spend less than 1 to 2% of our GDP on the justice system, but it costs us much more than that. There is also the impact that it has on the businesses. So the ease of doing business indicator, one of the major components of this is the cost incurred in judicial proceedings, in arbitration, in adjudication. So this is something that is being looked at globally by the World Bank, etc., and being given a lot of priority and weight. But unfortunately, in India, it's not something that's looked at as much as it should be.
Considering India has ambitions to be a 5 trillion economy, the high cost of judicial proceedings has the potential to become a barrier to investors. So just to sum up a few of the points that we've discussed, that increasing budgetary aid, which we've been talking about, is not going to be sufficient to transform the justice system. It requires a systemic approach. It requires a long-term view. And like Surya mentioned, it requires, I think, an injection of funds, increased funds over a sustained period of time, if we are to see any sort of change in the justice system. Any last thoughts before we finish?
As a nation, while we're transitioning from an agrarian economy, from a rural economy to an urban industrial, it is important to understand that the nature of dispute resolution is also going to change, the needs and the pressures of the dispute resolution system. Earlier, there was a family, there was a rural headman, there was the religious leaders. All of that is going to change over the next 25 years. So unless we are putting the trust in the formal justice resolution system, it is going to lead to a lot of social costs and prove costly for the nation in the long term. So the time to act was yesterday.
Radhika, any closing thoughts?
I agree with Surya completely. And I also think that we need to shift our focus a little and look at the justice system more comprehensively, look at what causes criminal justice system specifically to be so overburdened, and maybe address some of the root causes of this instead of simply focusing on incarceration and long drawn litigation. These are things which ultimately in the long term are going to harm our economy and our system only, and overburden our system with a lot of unnecessary litigation and cost of incarceration. So maybe we should also experiment a little with ways in which we can settle a lot of the disputes and maybe try to look at more community-oriented justice instead of the cut-and-dry methods that we use right now.
This conversation has been an eye-opener for me, shows how superfluous most people's understanding is of the judicial system. Thank you so much, Surya, and thank you, Radhika, for being here today and spending this time at the end of a very long day for you. I truly appreciate it.
Thank you, Sudha.
Thank you. Thank you, Sudha.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Elephant in the Room podcast, brought to you by The Purpose Room in partnership with the India Justice Report. Don't forget to subscribe to the show. And if you enjoyed listening to the podcast today, don't forget to write a review and tell your friends.